Hello and welcome to another edition of the InfoQ Podcast. The InfoQ Podcast is a weekly podcast with thought leaders in software. Many of our guests are current past speakers of QCon, a software conference that both myself and Daniel Bryant, my co-hosts on the show, are involved with. Today on the podcast, I'm talking to Josh Wills. Josh is a software engineer working on data engineering problems at Slack, specifically with machine learning and on the infra team. Prior to that, he led data science teams at Cloudera and at Google. One notable thing about Josh, in his words, after doing management for a bit, he discovered that he really didn't like it all that much and went back to the development ranks. So we'll talk a bit about that. Today on the podcast, though, we're mainly going to be focused on observability. We're going to be talking specifically about observability and how it relates to machine learning models. If you're not an ML engineer, don't turn it off just yet. There's a lot of interesting things in here that we'll talk about the Elk stack, about Prometheus, and how that relates, these tools that we're already familiar with, DevOps, and how that relates to operating a machine learning environment. So stay tuned, you'll love it. This podcast references and builds off of a talk that Josh did at QCon AI this past April. That talk was called Instrumentation, Observability, and Monitoring of Machine Learning Models. Yes, it's a wordy title, but we'll probably talk about that too. But if all this interests you, take a look at InfoQ.com, look for Josh Wills' name, and you will find the talk. Josh, this podcast took a little bit to get together, but I'm happy to finally have you on the show. Welcome.
Thank you, Wes. Thanks so much for having me. I'm really excited to be here.
The introduction, I said that you tried your hand at management and you found you preferred being more of an individual contributor. Tell me about that.
Oh, man, so many feelings on that. So I've done mostly like technical work for most of my career. So I just turned 40 and I've been doing this for about 18 years now. And the vast majority of that time, I was doing tech lead kind of roles, like some kind of technical leadership sort of thing. And when I was at Cloudera, I was the director of data science, but I was largely like a DevRel kind of role. And DevRel is, and I hope the DevRel people don't mind me saying so, like the easiest management job in the world. Because management at its core is about doing two things. It's about getting stuff done, and it's about developing your people. And in DevRel, I found that management was relatively easy because in a sense, like developing people is the thing you're supposed to do. Like I want every evangelist, like developer advocate kind of person who works for me to become like a famous and prominent and important developer relations person. Like that's what they want and that's what I want. And so we kind of have perfect alignment. Whereas like traditional engineering management, there's always a fair amount of just, you know, like crap, unfun, like tedious work that has to get done. And I would love to be able to just give everyone, you know, super fun stuff that they want to work on all the time. But that's just sadly not the reality of building a company and building a team. So I wanted to try my hand at Slack at doing kind of real management is what I said. Like we're developing people is in some ways in conflict or at least is not obviously aligned with the stuff you have to get done. And so that's what I did. And I think I was not very good at it for a bunch of different reasons. One of which is kind of sort of funny. I think in some ways, like spending like a couple of years at Cloudera doing DevRel and talks and tweets and blog posts and stuff kind of ruined me for any sort of real job because I really got very accustomed to doing more or less whatever I wanted whenever I felt like it. And like just using my own judgment as to what and what was interesting and what wasn't. And, you know, in management, like especially senior management, like big part of the job is figuring out what your boss is interested in, what their boss is interested in, what your peer manager director types are interested in. And, you know, I just honestly, Wes, don't super care about that very much. I just don't. At least in certain domains, I kind of like think that I have a pretty good idea of what we should do. And I just kind of go and do that. And that isn't always what everyone thinks is best. I'm not perfect. I'm probably wrong about a lot of this stuff, but it does seem like, I guess, you know, in terms of like open source projects and stuff, I've always been kind of a fan of the benevolent dictator model, just in terms of efficiency and stuff like that. So yeah, anyway, TLDR, it just didn't make me like a great manager. Like, I think my reports like liked me and enjoyed working for me, but I'm pretty sure like other managers didn't.
But there's this thing like, right, you're developed for your individual contributor for so long and it's like, okay, now I got to go into management because, you know, it's just that time. So
yeah, I understand that instinct. I think it's wrong, but I certainly like understand the instinct. I think I did it like in an especially stupid way in that I started managing right after my son was born. So I started it after the birth of my first child, like literally thinking to myself, like just such an idiot that, oh man, I'm not going to be sleeping and I've got all this stuff with the new kid. So I'm just going to be way too tired for like technical work. I'm going to need to do like management stuff and just sit through meetings and stuff like that. Because, you know, in my IC days, I've always been fairly brain dead in meetings. So I'm like, okay, I can just go be brain dead all the time and it'll be fine.
But now you're an IC working with machine learning and data engineering. Let's talk a bit about that. So the genesis for this podcast comes from this talk that you did at KubeCon AI. But you got to explain this title before we get into it, because I think we had a character limit, and I think this one only barely got under the character limit.
I mean, Wes, like most of my titles in my talks, I just kind of like make up a very generic title that can work with whatever I actually want to talk about that day.
It's always a journey, right? You put a topic out there, you have to discover the talk that matches the title.
So true. So that's me doing that here. The genesis of this was when I started working on search at Slack, and we decided to get kind of serious about doing ML for like our search ranking and trying to dramatically improve the quality of our search ranking. We had to start, you know, like building services and building like production software. And I have, by and large, spent the vast majority of my career, you know, either working on like relatively small modules of large systems or doing like large scale system stuff, but offline stuff, like data engineering stuff, Hadoop stuff, like offline machine learning. So I never really, really had to do like serious production software where like this stuff has to be up or it's a really, really big deal. And so like working with our monitoring team, visibility team, and getting exposed to the tooling and like how they thought about problems and how they worked was kind of like a revelation to me. And again, not something that I in like my Jupyter notebooks and my Spark shell had really ever had to deal with. And so it was like kind of a revelation for me. I thought it was all like quite interesting and thought like other people with kind of my background would find like interesting and useful and stuff like that. So that was why I wanted to talk about it. I was kind of concerned it was going to be super boring to people. And like everyone just takes it for granted. I'm just dumb. I just didn't know it.
No, I really liked it. I liked it in particular because it took the tools that I'm intimately familiar with, kind of like just DevOps tools, talking about Prometheus and Elk Stack and things like that, and connected it to the world of machine learning. So it felt like there was like this middle ground between software engineering and data science and where the two met. So I really like the talk, and that's kind of what I wanted to do the podcast on. Before we jump into the details of that, let's level set a little bit about what Slack's architecture looks like today. First, when I think of Slack, I know Slack from talks over the last couple of years, and I've heard kind of unapologetically, we're a monolith. We have some services here and there, but that unapologetic, we're a monolith shop. I don't think that's quite the case anymore.
It was sort of funny. So when I joined Slack in 2015, there was an intro talk on my second day called Slack Mostly Works. And in about an hour, they more or less explained the entire Slack architecture. And it was super cool because kind of at the end of the second day, I could pretty much just like go to work. It was pretty great. And it's been interesting to see how it's evolved. So way back in the day, there was the PHP monolith, which was built much like Flickr was in 2005 by Cal Henderson.
When you say back in the day, what are we talking about? I mean, Slack started off as like a gaming chat company, and that was only like 8 years ago or so. It wasn't that long ago, was it?
2009, they started the game. The game is seen, I think, correctly as like core to the success of the company in the sense that like most of the work that Slack does is the chat system, is the actual like message server. We nowadays call it the message server industrial complex. It used to be a giant, you know, Java binary. And now it is several Java binaries, several Go services, a bunch of different systems that are all talking to each other to make this stuff scale out. But when I joined in 2015, a Slack team could be about 4,000 users, roughly speaking, before things started getting ugly and unpleasant. Nowadays, our largest team is like hundreds of thousands of users, all in sort of the same Slack instance. Like a lot of work's been done since then. The PHP monolith still exists, but it's been largely replaced with Hacklang and HHVM. So like we and Facebook are the two big heavy-duty hack people in the world. We used to shard our database very simply, team-based MySQL sharding, like again, like not rocket science. And now we use Vitesse, which was YouTube's MySQL sharding system, to be able to shard different systems, different ways. So channels are sharded one way, users are sharded a different way, teams are sharded a different way, so on and so forth. And then we've started, you know, wherever it made sense, we've carved out parts of the monolith to create dedicated services written in Go or Java, almost exclusively Go and Java, for doing like application, yeah, sort of application-aware object caching. All the search industrial complex kind of stuff are all like, it's a series of different Java services. Like we just basically break pieces out of the monolith. There's a really good article, by the way, by Shopify, where they talked about like migrating and refactoring their Ruby on Rails monolith to be something that they could modularize and scale and carve out into like independent systems. And we are actually like undergoing that same process right now to make it even easier to, you know, like break up this thing without, you know, stopping the world and like rewriting the application from scratch or building our own data center or all that other kind of like idiotic nonsense that people do sometimes. So yeah, that's kind of where we are now. So it's like it conceptually is the same, but like every sort of piece of the system has gotten much more complicated and is not just one big monolith anymore. It's like a dozen different services, I would say.
What about like on the data side? What does that look like?
Our data side stack is still, I think, largely pretty straightforward. And in some ways, it's still based on the system that I built way back in 2015. So all of our application logs are done in Thrift. We're sort of trying to migrate that over to Protobuf, as one does. But still, it's a lot of Thrift. It's getting processed through a big, big Kafka cluster that does hundreds of thousands of events per second. We keep everything in S3. We have a central Hive metastore for kind of keeping track of where stuff is and what the schema is. And we spin up, you know, generally EMR clusters, Elastic MapReduce clusters from Amazon as we need them. Use a lot of Presto, Airflow to coordinate the whole thing, a lot of Spark, a lot of Hive, a lot of Snowflake recently. Like Snowflake's kind of taken over and is doing a pretty great job for us, a lot of the business analytics side of things. We've adopted a key value store from Foursquare called Quiver. It's open source and you can use it. We brought it in-house and tweaked it a little bit. And we use it for publishing like key value oriented data from our data warehouse into our production system so we can serve like spam models, search ranking models, statistics, analytics, like that kind of stuff, broadly speaking. Slack is not really like a big kind of like reinvent the wheel, build our own X kind of place. And I generally like that. I kind of like tend to make fun of companies that go around just building stuff for fun. We don't build stuff for fun. We build stuff because we like absolutely have to and don't really have a choice. We do it kind of kicking and screaming. And I like that about this place.
A lot of consumer facing apps have like relatively few models and kind of like key areas where they might use models. And then other more enterprise companies have models like everywhere. Everything that they're doing, they're kind of like deploying models to be able to kind of tune different parts of the business. How's Slack? Is it mostly like the search side that models are deployed? Is it across the enterprise? What does that look like?
It's mostly the search side by a wide margin. That's where most of like the heavy duty machine learning stuff is. At its core, you know, sending messages back and forth is like the thing we do very, very well. Don't want to dunk on anybody, but it's something we do much better, much, much better than anyone. I mean, it's kind of like back to the idea of like the game engine. The game was like the founding idea of the company. The message server industrial complex is basically a game engine. We took game developers, people who would be developing like Ultima Online or whatever, and had them build enterprise software.
How did you introduce machine learning? When did you discover that you needed to be able to instrument things better to operate those models?
There were two different, I think, things at play here, I would say. One, like we've done like modeling in some sense for like a long time. There was a highlights product that Slack launched, I think, a couple of years ago. It's largely like deprecated at this point. We don't really do like message highlighting anymore. People had always expressed the concern that Slack was this like source of information overload. It's been a long-term kind of complaint. And so we tried to apply machine learning first and foremost to attack the information overload problem. We didn't get very far with it for a bunch of different reasons. I mean, I think it would be glib of me to say it, but it's kind of like everyone has their own personal preference for like what they consider information overload. And they don't really want a computer kind of telling them like what is and is not like information that they need to be like considering or evaluating or something like that. There's sort of this notion of like people want their computer to be like their chief of staff, like in the sense of like a chief of staff who filters and routes information to you and only shows you stuff that's interesting. I know people who actually have like real live, like human chiefs of staff, and I don't know that they're even comfortable with like getting all their information filtered through someone. I don't want a chief of staff. Like I want like more of a customer service agent. Like I want someone to be able to say, I have a question about Spark or something. Find me everything Josh Wills has said about Spark. And like, what's the FAQ for like Josh on Spark stuff since he's written these books and done this stuff, right? And that's kind of what I would like. I would like something that just handles like the DMs I get from people and just let, you know, more or less leaves me alone. You know, like everything, I think like every sort of well-run company, we go with what our customers tell us. And so when we got serious about machine learning, we got serious about it because they were like, hey, Slack, your search ranking's like not good. Could you make it better? And there is fortunately like ample evidence in the industry and in the field that like you can use machine learning to make search ranking better.
So search ranking was the entry point. That's where you kicked off the machine learning products?
Where it was like the easiest, like most low-hanging fruit, I think, to like introduce ML for like learn to rank and stuff, just to make, you know, sort of orders of magnitudes improvements in like search quality metrics without too much trouble and without having to like kind of figure out like what the product should be. Like mostly like with ML these days, we can kind of do anything we want if we have the data. The hard part is generally like getting the data and figuring out like what should the product do.
Yeah, well, that's my next question. So you had all this data. It didn't mean it was the right data. How did you get this data, structure this data, and kind of go to that first machine learning product? And what did it look like?
The question really, in any kind of thing like this, is like, what are we trying to achieve? And the answer sort of glibly, right, is we would like the search results to be good. We would like people to quickly find relevant information that is relevant to the query they're looking for. How do we know if they found relevant information? And this is actually kind of a tricky thing for us. We are not Google. We don't have like a link structure for the Slack teams that we can like analyze. We can't build like PageRank per se. We have to look at user behavior. It's like, what do people do when they do a search? Like, what is an indication that a search has been good? Because sometimes like if the answer you want is just like right there in the page, like it's just right there in the search results, you just exit the search. And does that mean that you just found what you were looking for? Or does it mean that like you didn't, you know, you were like, oh, the search is terrible, I'm just going to give up, right? We can't see your messages. We can't even see your queries. So this is all like abstract behavior for us. We have no idea what the query is. We have no idea what the content of your messages are. We have to rely on the behavior. And by a wide margin, the most positive quality signal we get is when someone shares a search result into a channel. That is our gold standard of truth of like, this was a good search experience. This person was looking for something specific. They found it. They shared it back into the channel, right? That's the best possible world for us, whether it's a file or a message or anything like that, right? And so we train largely against that with like some other sort of things for like clicks and scrolls and like discount factors and like other things. But like at the end of the day, if you say like, what's the thing is like, does someone share the message? Is our single sort of quality signal, our North Star? Once you have that thing, it's like all the machinery, all of the tools, logistic regression, XGBoost, deep neural networks, everything like that. It's just there for you. It's gotten really, really good. And you can just kind of go to work.
Okay, so you got to the point where you could train a model offline based on criteria that you defined that works for you. What does the process look like at Slack for taking that model and getting it into the production environment, kind of promoting it, A-B testing, iterating it, all those kind of things?
Yes, I mean, that was the tricky thing. And that was what we had to do some building for. So we typically use trainer models in Spark. We typically use a Java-based library, Scala-based library, right? But, you know, like I alluded to before, our monolith is in PHP, or was for a long time. So how exactly do I translate the Java model into like the PHP code? How do I make that work? And we actually like tried this a few different times. Like we tried to build like an XGBoost binding. I swear to God, Wes, it was absolutely terrible. From like PHP via C++ via like JNI. Oh, it's just only like thinking about it, honestly. We finally just were kind of like, screw this. We're going to just build a Java service and just make this easier on ourselves. We're just going to like translate the feature code over. Because like at that point, like deploying the model is just like a stupid little file. Push the model to S3, load it up into the service, kind of off you go. The hard part was like actually building the Java service to do all this kind of stuff. And that was like, you know, I think Slack, for better or worse, has a reputation for, or at least had a reputation for a long time for not being the most stable, reliable service. So I've spent like most of the last 4 years of my life, like, you know, not most, but some of the more unpleasant parts of the last 4 years of my life, like, you know, being on Twitter when Slack is down and watching like literally everyone I know be like, oh, Slack is down, holiday, can't work, everything is terrible, all that kind of stuff, right? So I hate when Slack is down. I live and die when Slack is down. So a year ago, we just got very, very, very serious about reliability, just kind of like full stop. In a way, we'd been prioritizing moving fast, iterating as quickly as possible. We decided to prioritize slowing down and being up and being stable and being reliable and being available. Because I think honestly, if we had not had this, I would have never discovered any of this monitoring stuff, because I would have just been like, oh, I'm an engineer. Here you go. Here's a Java binary. It's up. It's running. It's talking. Call me, you know, if it breaks, I guess, like that kind of thing. So building like the kind of the harness that allowed us to build out this infrastructure, we started with using a library, again, kind of with our thesis of like not reinventing the wheel. There's a library, a tool called Armeria that was written by the folks over at Line, like Line Corp out in, you know, Japan, Korea, Asia. And the kind of primary developer on it is a guy named Trustin Lee, who some folks here knew from Twitter, who's one of the core Netty developers. And he built this just really, really great library. Like, I try to avoid the F word. Sorry, framework. Framework's the bad F word I'm trying to avoid here. I don't want to go so far as to call it a framework, because that would be, you know, pejorative and mean. But it's a really good library that comes with like the logging stuff, gRPC, Thrift, HTTP. It's very fast. It's very efficient. And so we built kind of our first Java services on top of it and started like, you know, wiring it up into a console and like all of the kind of different stuff we used. And that was what exposed me to this world. It was kind of like the sheer amount of work I had to do, the enormous amount of work I had to do to just serve a very tiny little XGBoost model in production was humbling and educational. At least serving it reliably, I guess, would be the part. Just serving it is easy. Serving it reliably is a whole different problem.
So let's talk about that. So the observability side. So now you've got these models. Now the framework you just mentioned came with some observability, it sounds like, from what you said.
Free Prometheus, free logs out of the box pretty quickly.
Okay. So you inherited Prometheus basically because of what you were using?
Yeah. So it's like we had an existing development environment like here, right? Like what is truth at Slack? It's like there's Chef and there's Console and there's like Logstash and there's all this stuff. You know, when I was like going looking for like, okay, I want to build a Java service. I wanted to interoperate with all these things. You know, it's like you're doing kind of like a refined series of Google queries. And, you know, it's like, I'm not looking for like a grad student project. I want to see something that's been developed by like serious people who work at serious companies with serious scale that I can like be confident probably works like reasonably well, like that kind of thing.
I guess where I'm trying to go is, what do you instrument? Like when you're talking about a machine learning problem, 90% of it is the data flowing through it. It's that 10% is the model. So what are you actually instrumenting? Are you in a deep learning? Every layer, you're trying to emit different decisions that are happening so you can trace those decisions. What are you doing?
I think it's like anything else, man. It's like you start with the most brain dead obvious stuff because that's the stuff that's going to screw you. You know, it's like, what are the inputs? Like, what am I seeing? Getting a field, like what values do I expect to see? Is it a string? Is it going to be 2 characters? Is it going to be 20 characters? Like when I parse it, like how many sort of tokens do I expect to see? I'm generally speaking loath to ever go deep instrumenting into the black box of the model itself, generally speaking, because I'm planning on swapping that thing out. Like that model has a relatively short shelf life in its existence. And the thing that generally like burns me is really much more along the lines of like the inputs have changed, drifted substantially, or I'm missing stuff that I'm going to see. Like that's generally where I'm going to get screwed. And it's just like, I feel like it's the kind of thing where a developer can generally like take it for granted in the sense that like if you're using like whatever it is we call Swagger now or Thrift or gRPC, like you fully specify the API of like what you're expecting to see. And since you're not like feeding the inputs generally into like spaghetti code, like you're just feeding it through code that you wrote yourself or like humans wrote, they can't really like destroy you in the way that like it doesn't require the level of sort of detailed specification on top of like essentially like infinite dimensional inputs that are available to you in like a machine learning problem. Like, so in theory, like the queries, right? It can be anything in some sense, like the complete set of text strings expressible in Unicode is a potential like valid input that we should have to provide an answer for.
But I guess what I'm hearing is like, it's not rocket science. It's the things that you would log no matter what on any system. It just happens to be wrapping around a machine learning problem.
Exactly. I think it was something I took for granted, I think, as an API developer or like as a log developer. And it's where I get into like, you know, it's how we sort of seg into like test in production, because you can't possibly test every impossible input. You can't possibly auto-generate the validation code for every possible input. It just can't be done.
The tools we're talking about, traditional Elk Stack, so Logstash, Elasticsearch, Kibana, we're talking about, you already mentioned Prometheus, so we're talking about Prometheus, tracing, I'm sure, in there. So these are the tools we're talking about, right?
Absolutely. I think there are some companies and folks who are trying to talk about like doing machine learning specific observability tools. I don't quite see it. Like, I'm just not there yet. The tools we have seem like pretty good to me. I mean, if you're developing a new tool simply because you have not bothered to get familiar with the existing tools, it's sort of like we're back to the world of like, why are you writing your own key value store? Like, what is the point of this?
Oh, so where's the difference? Okay, so where now do you have to calibrate your thinking to align with machine learning? Are there certain things that when you're, you know, doing logs and metrics and tracing for a machine learning pipeline or machine learning solution that maybe might be different than just an API?
I would say in theory, no. In practice, yes.
What's that mean?
I'm giving you a very like sort of bullshitty machine learning answer. Yeah. And I think it's like I've always had religion around structured data and structured logs, right? But I've really gotten religion around tracing, around spans, around like that kind of level of structure and leveraging tools. Logstash is fantastic. I can throw anything I want there. Prometheus is fantastic. It's great for like counting very straightforward, you know, things in with like with a little bit of cardinality thrown in there. We use Honeycomb here. We do like sort of traces and spans. And I don't know what like framework, it's just all traces and spans as far as I can tell. But like high cardinality events where I can generate a unique identifier for every single request and trace it through like my entire system from talking to my key value store to my web server to my ranking server to my solar cluster and all the way back again, like down to the mobile client if I want to, is like absolutely amazing. I basically feel like I'm getting the speed of Grafana and Prometheus data. Like that's the virtue of it, right? It's like really, really fast and I get it quickly. with the level of detail and deep dive that I can get from Logstash. I think I had the Spotify infra team in for like lunch one day. We just do lunches and stuff around here. And I was asking them, Spotify, you guys do everything right. Everything's great. How's your Logstash cluster? And they're like, oh, it's a total disaster, dumpster fire. Like, it is everywhere, right? Because you can throw anything in there. And that's exactly what we do. We go ahead and throw anything in there. Whereas if you take the time to provide a little bit of structure, not a lot of structure, little bit of structure that you can kind of pipe through the entire system, you can let the backend query engine do so much of the work for you and like optimize things so much that you can just work, iterate so much faster when things break. You can trace specific user is having problems. The specific version of the server software with this particular feature flag on is having problems. Like this kind of stuff is just, feeling like I can see the data and get answers as quickly as I can in Grafana while being able to dive into the detail when I need to like figure out what the hell is going on. Oh my God, Wes. It's so amazing. I love it so much. I don't know how people worked without this.
Yeah, that's awesome. Any tips, any tricks, any lessons, anything that might be useful?
I'm like the world machine learning expert who tells people not to do machine learning. I don't know what it is. It's like, most of the time, it's like if you're doing a problem, I'm really just deeply hoping that machine learning is not actually the only thing left. Like you really want to kind of exhaust all other possibilities. We're fixing our spam machine learning models right now, but we got like pretty far with just like some fairly stupid rules for like a long time. Didn't really require a bunch of work. It was pretty straightforward. It was really stable, like that kind of thing. You can get a long way without machine learning. I guess it's like, I generally do not feel like most machine learning practitioners appreciate what is required to build a production service. I just really don't have, like most people have any idea, broadly speaking. And I'm projecting somewhat because I'm like reflecting on me a year ago where like I really had like absolutely no idea what this stuff entailed or thought that because I can do machine learning, I am the smartest person in the world. I can do anything, right? And that's just like deeply, very much not the case. So yeah, mentality shift, I think, is more than anything, is like the hard thing.
In this talk, you actually mentioned a paper, ML Test Rubric, a 2017 version, not the 2015 version?
The second version, exactly, the modern version.
In there, you mentioned there's a bunch of little rules, for example. You want to talk about some of those?
I think it's sort of broken up into like four different like subsections covering kind of every aspect of building machine learning models. I mean, I guess like from like your offline data validation and testing, to like in your offline monitoring solution, like be it counters or accumulators, like you're kind of equivalent of like Prometheus for all intents and purposes, right? Just done via like Hadoop and Spark. Anomaly detection in your offline systems and your modeling systems is incredibly valuable, almost as valuable as it is in your online systems. What I almost sort of want is like a one-to-one kind of mapping from like concepts in online production monitoring to offline monitoring of systems. A lot of times it's just like renaming things, but the kind of principles apply in both places. The rubric, I think, is really just exhaustive and is fantastic and is generated by people who have been burned very badly by unfortunate machine learning driven production outages. It's also like so comprehensive as to be like impossible to actually like cover. there's like sort of 50 different checklist items and, there's an 80-20 sort of principle that applies here. So I think, in my dotage, in my retirement, I will write some sort of like way evaluation system for deciding which like things you should do. But I mean, beyond like a fairly militant focus on just like inputs and outputs, if you don't have an infinite set of inputs, then you don't actually have a machine learning problem, like first and foremost. And once you do acknowledge that you have an infinite set of inputs, being methodical at every stage, whether testing, monitoring, every sort of stage of the pipeline, offline training, online serving, the whole thing, about what is coming your way. And then I think the other thing, which I guess is not really kind of covered in the paper, is really like the communication between the offline system and the online system. I mean, how tightly coupled those things really have to be. Because what I see like a lot of times around machine learning, like you can do everything right offline, like everything right. But if you're doing everything right offline, you're going to spend like 6 months to build like one model. And by the time that model's done in the offline system with all of its testing and all of its monitoring and blah, 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 the production world has changed. The production world isn't the same world anymore. So like the model is like kind of useless.
When we kicked off this, we talked a bit about this journey you took into management as an individual contributor and came back. You're about to start a new journey. When we release this podcast, you'll be in a new journey. What are you going to be doing?
I will be. So my last day at Slack is November 1st. And so I will be unemployed. I will be super dad, I think, for a little while. So yeah, I moved to San Francisco in 2007 from Austin, and I did Google, and I did Cloudera, and I did Slack, and Google was a lot of fun back then. Cloudera, we grew from 84 to about 1,000 or so when I left. Slack grew from about 240 to almost 2,000 now when I left. And so I'm pretty tired. I'm tired and I'm looking forward to traveling for a bit. And more than anything, just looking forward to kind of getting bored. I guess basically, like, maybe the most consistent piece of advice I've gotten from folks is, like, allow yourself to get bored. Figure out what you want to do when you're bored. Yeah, I'm looking forward to getting bored.
Well, Josh, I appreciate you fitting in this podcast before you get bored. And I look forward to catching up with you soon.
Thanks a lot, Wes. Thanks for having me. I really appreciate it.
What is happening in the programming language world? Which language has gained wider adoption? Check the Programming Languages Trends Report to make informed mid- and long-term decisions, or to choose wisely where you invest your time.